I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the London Review Bookshop. It's a real pleasure to introduce David Harvey and Owen Hathley, and welcome them here this evening. They're both perfectly familiar to you, of course. David Harvey needs absolutely no introduction. His companions to volumes of Marx's Capital are the canonical companions to that work. We last had him in the shop for 17 Contradictions and the End of Capitalism with a different Owen Jones, a couple of years ago, odd and very good it was. And he's here this evening to launch the new book, Marx, Capital and the Madness of Economic Reason, released just recently. And he'll be in conversation with Owen Hathley, whose most recent book is Landscapes of Communism. Anyway, isn't it? What's the new one?
There's been two, sir.
The devil?
Yeah, and you stopped them. You've got no excuse.
I just didn't know what order they came in. What is the latest?
I'll turn off the mic.
Oh, it's the Chaplin Machine. Yes, of course it's the Chaplin Machine.
No one's bought that one, so the more help it
can. For heaven's sake, get your hands on the Chaplin Machine after this event. Yes, I did. Yes, it's jolly good, that one. They'll be in conversation for about 45 minutes, following which there'll be time for questions from the floor on this roving mic. Welcome, David and Owen.
So, why this book now, and why, sort of after sort of 17 Contradictions, why the, how does this differ from those in its arguments and its approach?
Well, I'm not sure it differs. I'll probably be accused of repeating myself endlessly. I have been on a project in a way over the last 15, 20 years really, to try and make Marx's work more accessible and comprehensible. To try to simplify it without being simplistic, which is a very difficult game to play. You sometimes fall down one side or you go on the other. But that's been part of what I've been doing, and it seemed to me that there were some loose ends, as always in previous presentations. And one thing I had not done was to try to give an overview of the totality of Marx's thinking across the three volumes of Capital and what they might mean in contemporary situations. So I really decided to try to take that particular angle. At the same time, taking that angle, I suppose it's a bit arrogant of me to say this, but I wanted to breathe a bit of life into Marxist discussion, which seemed to me to be often getting lost in the dead weight of dogmatism and scholasticism and all the rest of it. So I wanted to wake it up.
On which note, we should remind you that the Historical Materialism Conference begins tomorrow. There's one point early on where you sort of mention certain recent books on Marx that are mass market, as it were, which are Jonathan Sperber and Gareth Stephen-Jones' books.
Right.
And there seems to have been this sort of move where, I suppose in the sort of 60s and 70s, people like sort of Althusser and Kowakowski, and very, for very different reasons, sort of tried to redefine Marx as a philosopher, right, essentially. And now there's a sort of movement to sort of define him as a sort of great Victorian whose works are not particularly useful to us otherwise. And you give that very short shrift. There's sort of one can get to the end of the Stephen-Jones and Sperber volumes without having the foggiest clue as to what Marx's concept of capital was all about, let alone how it might be put to good use today. Marx's analyses, though obviously dated in some ways, are, I find, even more relevant now than they were at their time of writing. He seems to be sort of, you know, insisting on a definition of Marx as someone whose political, sort of whose life's project was to describe and to analyse and to critique capital first and foremost, and that this is still a deeply relevant project.
Well, whether it's first and foremost, in a sense, doesn't really
foremost
matter,
rather than
matter,
first, let's say,
matter to me that much. All I know is that he did write at great length on the critique of classical political economy. He tried, on the basis of that critique, to identify what he called the laws of motion of capital. He did try to bring together many different aspects of how the economy was working. He was very well aware of its internal inconsistencies, its contradictions. And so to me, this is a very interesting framework to look at the economy of the time. And I was today thinking aloud, and Sperber was on there and kind of went into his little thing. And I had to point out to him that Marx did not write a book about capitalism. He wrote a book about capital and the laws of motion of capital, which I would depict as being the engine inside of a much more complicated kind of society, which is called capitalism with all of its political and social and cultural configurations. And that definition of capital was actually extremely useful to me. And particularly when you looked at how Marx conceived of it across the three volumes of Capital. So when you put the three volumes together, you get a very different picture than if you just read volume one. And I had this kind of little crusade to get the English-speaking world, at least, out of what I call volume one-itis, which is a kind of disease of reading volume one and saying, that's it. And that's the end of the story. And you kind of go, well, no, I know volume two is rather boring to read, but you've got to read it, because you won't understand Marx's concept of capital if you don't get that part of it. And you've got to read volume three as well. So you've got to do these things. And Sperber doesn't do those things. He has very sort of old-fashioned, almost conventional view of Marx and the labor theory of value and things like that, and then kind of say, this is all useless, it's all been shown as nonsense, so we don't have to consider Marx's theory. But I think it's still a very vibrant thing, if you accept it's an unfinished thing. We've got to finish it up, we've got to tidy it up, we've got to extend it, we've got to develop it. And that's what I try and do a bit in the book. Say it has it's the basis for something else.
This is probably the part where I should confess I've only read volume one.
Okay, bye.
But there's very useful exegeses of the three volumes in this book, and I wonder if you could sort of for these people give some sort of summary of the particular contemporary relevances you find in those three volumes. You're quite scornful of volume two. I can't say I was rushing to go and read volume two after your presentation of it.
Oh.
It did make it sound extremely abstract.
Well, it is very abstract, yeah. But what Marx was good at was defining abstractions. And then what he said was the real science begins when you take those abstractions and try to bring them to bear on a particular society in a particular place and time. And that's where the real science begins, and he never did that with volume two. Now, if you look at my own work, more of my own work is dealing with things like space and time, and ideas about speed up and time-space compression, all those kinds of things. Well, that all came out of volume two, but it was me taking the volume two abstract theory and trying to do the science around it to this explains something that's going on in our society this time. I mean, why is consumerism becoming much faster now? Well, because capital has inherent within it this kind of thing's going to go faster. Has to go faster for competitive reasons. And as it goes faster, it means that we need to create commodities like cell phones that have a new version about every 2 years, and everybody rushes off to buy the new version. I mean, the turnover time of consumption is becoming much more rapid now. We live a different kind of spatio-temporal rhythm, and that has a lot to do with the dynamics of a capitalist system that is about time-space acceleration.
There's quite a lot of sort of critiques, sort of implicit and otherwise, in this book of about sort of using Marx, or the sort of assumption that one can only use Marx to describe, I guess, the sort of early 20th century capitalism of sort of gigantic factories and sort of direct point of production struggles. And there's some quite nice passages on that that I want to go over. Struggles at the point of valorization inevitably have a class character, which is much theorized and well known. Those at the point of realization focus on buyers and sellers and trigger fights against predatory practices and accumulation by dispossession in the marketplace, e.g. against gentrification and foreclosures. Such struggles are not well theorized. In the field of social reproduction, issues of social hierarchy, gender, sexuality, kinship and family and the like become much more predominant, and the primary political focus shifts to the qualities of daily life rather than the labor process. These struggles have often been ignored in the Marxist literature. And you're very keen not to ignore them. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. I think the couple of issues here. One is what did Marx consider and why? And then what have Marxists historically concentrated on? And I think there's no question that Marxists have been enamored of Volume 1 of Capital, which is a lot about the struggle that occurs at the point of production. It's about organizing at the point of production. It's about the classic class struggles and all the things that Marxists typically like to write about. Now, I don't want to say that's unimportant. I sometimes get accused of saying I'm neglecting that. I'm not neglecting that at all, but I'm saying there are these other struggles. For example, a hedge fund buys up a pharmaceutical company and a pill that was very necessary for certain kinds of diseases, which was selling at $7 a pill, suddenly is being sold at $750 a pill. Now, somebody's making an enormous profit out of that. It's not a point of the production struggle. It's actually occurring at the point of realization. And the difference between production and realization is very important to me. I mean, I'd like to use the example of an Apple computer. An Apple computer is produced in China, say. I know bits and pieces come from everywhere, but let's say China. The value of it is realized in the United States. And Apple has a huge kind of rate of return on its capital. The place that produced it has almost nothing. And this is how Walmart works. This is how a lot of the merchant capitalists now work. IKEA, everybody, they squeeze their direct producers, which is where Marx would say value is produced. And then they extract all of the value at the point of realization. And then there are struggles at the point of realization, because if you start to ask people, what are the things that bother you? They'll say, well, all these charges on my credit card, all these charges on my phone, In other words, daily life gets a center of a lot of agitation. Mm-hmm. And the traditional Marxist way is to look at it as being rather secondary. Now, I don't think that is what actually Marx said. Uh-huh. Marx said, you've got to understand production and you've got to understand realization in the market. And he talked about a contradictory unity between production and realization. And if they can't make the money and get all of the goodies at the point of production, they get it at the point of realization. Uh-huh. So those struggles, but those struggles are not class struggles in the ordinary sense. Anybody who needs that pill is affected. It could be a rich person, could be a poor person. It's between buyers and sellers. Mm-hmm. So Marx identifies that, and I kind of go, well, actually, those struggles between buyers and sellers are actually many of the things that go on in our contemporary society, and therefore we should integrate them and see them as part of the... That's what you see when you look at the totality of Marx's Capital. You see that there are these different points of struggle. There are struggles in the field of distribution, struggles over the realization of value in the market, and struggles at the point of production. And the interesting thing for the left is, how do you put all of that together?
Mm. Now, as someone sort of somewhat excessively obsessed with the past, I was very struck in Rebel Cities by some of the comments in there on the Paris Commune. Because you wrote this wonderful book on Paris about 15 years ago, is that about right? Thereabouts.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of argument in there that the Paris Commune is in many ways a sort of more relevant model for the sort of struggles that you're describing there of sort of over gentrification or foreclosure and so forth, over rent, than the sort of Petrograd Soviet Putilov works model that socialists, or particularly kind of the kind of far left, have been very attached to.
Yeah, well, I always liked the fact that the first two things that the commune did was to suspend night work in the bakeries, which is classic kind of working point of production problem, and moratorium on rents, mm-hmm. which is a classic kind of distribution realization mm-hmm. problem. So that the commune was working across all of those things, and in fact. You will know this better than anybody, I think, given your work on Eastern Europe. The urban centre has lots of struggles going on, no matter where you are, which are very political and have very important political meaning. But you can't absorb them into simply a point of production question. They become questions in their own right, and therefore we have to have a way of connecting them. To the, what's happening in the general economy. And my point here about trying to see the totality of what Marx was talking about, you can see where the urban struggles might be located.
But there's a point also in there sort of related to the sort of 19th century Paris as this sort of constant churn of socialist ideas with respect to the putting out system. You mentioned L'Assommoir by Zola and these kind of descriptions of this particular mode of labour in the 19th century, which suggests, again, has sort of certain sort of contemporary resonances that aren't to be found in, you know, the sort of Manchester model as well.
Well, I think on that, you know, the Marx tended often to be a bit teleological about things. I'm putting it out mildly. He sometimes becomes very teleological about things. And there is a sense in which he sometimes seems to say that the factory system will drive out all other forms of labour organisation and we'll all end up sort of in a factory, as it were. And I think that the reality of the situation is that there are many different labour systems. We see in contemporary digital labour, for example, forms of labour organisation and labour configuration, which Marx was not familiar with. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, well, on that topic, we have to go beyond what Marx did and recognise the variety of labour systems that come into being.
But you mentioned this sort of coming out of Marx's critique of Proudhon.
Yeah.
And his sort of emphasis on, you know, on the sort of small-time sort of craft labour and the way that his particular version of socialism comes out of this kind of trying to liberate these small producers.
Yes.
There's a sort of little passage on here, sort of, differences that separate Proudhon and Marx reflect the different labour systems they addressed. It follows that Marx should reevaluate our own categories to reflect contemporary labour practices. The contemporary labour that Marx assumed of the future of capitalism has been much diminished in advanced capitalist countries and the teleology that you mentioned. So do you then get very dismissive of what you describe as Proudhonian types of monetary interventions of local currencies and time sharing and labour time monies and so forth.
Yes.
Could you expand a bit about on that?
Oh, at length.
You don't? Well, I
think that, well, there's a tendency. I mean, this goes back to the argument I had in the late 70s, early 1980s with Fiore and Sable, which kind of said these small scale production systems are revolutionizing what capital is about, and they came up with the theory of flexible specialization, which they saw as being an emancipatory for the labor force. And I argued at the time, well, no, this is not flexible specialization, this is flexible accumulation, because if it is developed under capitalist social relations, it will be organized in such a way as to emphasize the profitability of it for capitalist firms, and that's what capitalist firms effectively did. What worries me about many of these other suggestions, you know, local currencies and Bitcoin and everything else, is they have two possibilities. One is they can be a sort of minor feature of a situation and never actually get to things like, well, what the hell are you going to do about the central banks? What are you going to do about the current power of the state apparatus and the treasury and all the rest of it? You're not going to get that far that way. The other problem, it seems to me, is that there's no such thing as a good idea on the left that capital hasn't figured out how to co-opt.
Yes, right.
And you see this in the story of Uber, and you see it in Airbnb, and you see all these kinds of things like this, which initially, when they come along, look like a good idea. fantastic, it's emancipatory in some way or other, but within 6 months, the capitalists have figured out a way to capitalize it and turn it into something, which becomes a great profit spinner.
This seems that would connect this with your sort of very brusque words for sort of Paul Mason and the kind of cult of the fragment on machines.
Oh, yeah.
That you're sort of very, very dismissive of this kind of idea that we can, that if we somehow sort of accelerate some of these sort of processes of precarity or of sort of Bitcoin or what have you, or automation, we will then sort of break on through to the other side. And you're very scornful of this, which I am.
I think Paul Mason's a brilliant journalist, and I think some of the journalism he did around Tahrir Square and all of that was fantastic, and I think that on that. But then I think he fell victim to, you know, this kind of techno-utopian fantasy, which seems to be partially located on the left, but it's also located on the Silicon Valley crowd. Oh. I'm a bit dismissive of that the great future is going to be by the way in which peer-to-peer, computing and precarity can be turned into a kind of emancipatory way of life. Well, I don't see that.
Can we move on from that to talking about crisis? I think one of the kind of like very, very sort of banal, you know, kind of man at the Economist sort of ideas about Marx, the sort of idea that crises are the thing that will destroy capital, destroy capitalism. You've got some very nice passages in this on the sense in which crisis becomes almost a sort of health check for the system, almost kind of becomes a sort of sickness that then recovers from more healthily. There's this one passage I want to read, which is, "Why would financiers celebrate the violent outbreaks of crises? At first blush, this seems counterintuitive. But when it comes to the circulation of anti-value, then a crisis is indeed a moment of triumph for the forces of anti-value, even as it visits despair upon all those engaged in the production and realization of value. In a crisis, said the banker Andrew Mellon in the 1920s, assets return to their rightful owners, i.e. him." This seems very vindicated by the sort of obvious fact that the crisis that sort of began nearly 10 years ago has not brought down the system in any visible way. And where do you think this misreading comes from?
Marx in his early writings did tend to think that crises were going to mark the end of capitalism and everything. So But the longer he lived and researched, and I think it's very important to understand that Marx is a dynamic thinker. He was constantly changing his mind, which leads people to kind of accuse him of inconsistencies. But if he didn't change his mind, he wouldn't have got to where he finally got to. He did change his mind about that and kind of start to say, well, actually, crises are points of renewal of the system. Something new comes out of the crisis. And actually, if you look historically, you would see a crisis and you would always see something new coming out of it. What is so interesting about 2007, 2008 is that, as far as I can see, nothing new has come out of this.
Which is precisely Mason's argument, in a way, that Mason sort of argues that there isn't actually a fix for this, therefore it's completely different and completely new.
Well, it could be new in the sense that nothing has come out of it, except that to actually continue with the neoliberal line, I mean, effectively, the upper classes have gained immensely. If you look at all the data on income inequality, they've increased since 2007, 2008. In the States, the upper top 1% has increased its well-being by welfare, or well, not welfare, but their wealth by about something like 12 or 15%. The rest of the country has either remained stagnant or is lost. So there's a tremendous transfer of wealth that goes on in the course of a crisis, which is what Andrew Mellon's talking back in the 1920s. And this is what's happened this time. So you get a situation where the capitalists are doing very well, but capitalism is doing rather badly.
Yes.
And I think all the time you've got that situation, and all the time the capitalists control the media, control the, you know, the political process, control ideology and all the rest of it, you've got a situation where you're probably not going to get that much change because they're benefiting far too much from it. Mm-hmm. The only thing that's going to be able to change it is a real revolutionary transformation, which is why it seems to me we should be really looking at the Russian Revolution and saying, what does that mean? And this, of course, then raises the question of, how do we get a transformation which doesn't deal with kind of a small scale, which is what much of the left is now concerned with, but actually does deal with what I would call the state finance nexus, which is how the state is now in alliance with, you know, the financiers and can do what it's done to Greece and can do what it's done to Puerto Rico and will do that around the world, do what it did to Southeast Asia in 1997, 98, which, interestingly, the Chinese view as the greatest robbery that's ever occurred, which is the financial institutions causing a crisis in there by speculative activity, forcing the people to go out of business, buying up all the assets very cheaply, then waiting for a recovery, and then selling them back at a huge profit. We see that in the United States with the foreclosed housing. People, you know, hedge funds going in, buying up all this California housing and for a song, foreclosed stuff, and now sort of, you know, profiteering off it. So what we're seeing is the use of crises to actually rob, which is why I get back to the notion of accumulation by dispossession being significant, as opposed to the extraction of wealth from the employment of labor, which is still going on. Don't get me wrong, it's still going on big time.
There's a lot in here about debt, sort of kind of against David Graeber in some ways. You sort of argue for a very specifically capitalist form of debt. Could you talk about that briefly?
Well, there is a problem when people... I mean, Marx was very, very clear about this. I mean, and again, I always take his methodological commentaries very seriously. And he basically says, you know, there are concepts around like rent and debt and even money, which are given specific meanings in specific historical situations. And the meaning of those concepts under capitalism is completely different from what it was in, say, late feudalism, when there was indeed a wage labor market, there was indeed debt, yes, indeed, there were all the plenty of money around. But Marx kind of says the meaning of these things changes radically when the whole kind of mode of production changes, and that therefore each mode of production will give a specific meaning to its categories. And Graeber kind of takes debt, and he's actually very good about writing about Sumer and what happened with debt and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. He then gets to about the 18th century, and then the whole thing falls apart. He has no analysis of the specifically capitalist form of debt. Mm-hmm. But then what he does is to take the solutions of ancient Sumer, which are debt jubilees and things like that, and pretends you can put them in our situation. I have to point out to him, my pension is invested in debt, and you do a debt jubilee, I lose my pension, and soon everybody is, we're in a different world, you know, and that connectivity is really very, very important.
Before we go to questions, I want to talk about the madness of economic reason, given it's in the title. There's some quite nice sort of specific examples of that madness, the Sao Paulo car factories in particular, the sort of description of a sort of endlessly congested city whose economy is based on building the cars that creates its endless congestion and endless pollution.
Yeah.
That sort of idea that there's a madness to this, do you think that's become madder of late, or do you think it's a sort of madness inherent to capital?
I think it's a madness inherent in capital, and it's a madness that has been taken on board by the economists and fetishized to the point where you have a mad discipline, which is economics. And I think this was most clearly represented, and I don't quote it in here, but I used this in the Enigma of Capital, which is to say, you know, when the Queen kind of said to the economists, why the hell didn't you see this crisis of 2007 and 8 coming? They didn't know what to say to her. And they went off and they brought all the people through on the British Academy, and they kind of did a big thing, and then they wrote back to her and said, well, it seems that we missed something. And what we missed was systemic risk. And, you know, and I was saying this afternoon, would you like to land at an airport where they had done no examination of systemic risk? The answer would be, you know, one of the first things you look at in any system would be systemic risk. Would you like to get on a boat where nobody done any analysis of systemic risk? And you have this whole discipline that in 2009 or whenever it was, confessed it had no theory of systemic risk. And then you kind of say, well, actually Marx has a very interesting way of talking about systemic risk. He calls it contradictions.
Now, when you start talking to economists about contradictions, their eyes glaze over and kind of go like this. Marx has a very interesting way of talking about them, as I quote in here. He says, economists can't stand contradictions. So what they do is they pretend they don't exist. And as they pretend they don't exist, then they analyze the world as if it doesn't exist. You know, so this is the problem. And part of that comes back, it seems to me, to the whole abandonment of the labor theory of value. And there's lots of problems with the labor theory of value. I'm not going to pretend it was all kind of worked out and all this kind of thing. But it comes back to the fact that, you know, Marx had a labor theory of value which gave an angle of critique which was internal to capitalism, so that you no longer sat down and said, oh, it was due to nature or it was a mistaken political decision. No, Marx kind of says it's inherent in the system to generate these contradictions. Oh. And these contradictions are basically come out from looking at the relationship between the value form and the monetary form. And that the way the monetary form has got out of line with value production is one of the big, big questions of our own time. I mean, the IMF produced a report the other day that kind of said that at the minimum, the world is now in debt globally to the tune of something like 250% of the GDP of the world. Now, back in 1970, if any country got to be debt to GDP ratio more than about, you know, 90%, then the IMF was called out to go and give them structural adjustment. Right now, you've got a situation where the world is 250% indebted in relationship to GDP, and nobody seems to want to do anything about it. They're kind of saying, I mean, you would have thought since 2007, 2008, the debt thing would have gone down. In fact, it's accelerated. It's accelerated at a dramatic rate, you know, not only in this part of the world, but also in China and everywhere else. It just exploded. And then you have this question of what's going to happen as this debt, which is the foreclosure of the future, and that's one of the things I'm very emphatic about here. Debt forecloses the future. Students who have debt have to spend a lot of time working off the debt. If you're heavy debt indebted, you know. And actually, this is a form of social control. One of the things that was said about mortgage debt in the 1930s was that debt-encumbered homeowners don't go on strike. It was a form of social control. And so the more indebted we are, the more we've got, you know, we don't have any choice. We've got to spend our lives getting rid of the debt. And I kind of describe it there. This is, we're moving into a kind of peculiar situation of debt peonage, which is a global situation. And we've got to figure out how to deal with the debt. And you can't do it with the IMF announcing a jubileum or something like that. I mean, you just can't do it that way. So this is a really, really big question for me. And it's one of the things that, again, this is all analyzed in Volume 3 of Capital. Uh-huh. And my point here is that this is a different story, and you get a different story by the study of Volume 3 of Capital, which is too often dismissed. I mean, I was in a conference with Tony Negri just this last summer, who said, Volume 3 is totally useless. It doesn't tell you anything of any interest. And you kind of, well, of course, it doesn't talk about labor, which is what he likes to talk about all the time. But, you know, you kind of go, well, actually, you should be looking at Volume 3, because Volume 3 is where Marx, in a crazy kind of way, is actually getting to the heart of some of the issues that we need to look at. I mean, it's not complete, and it's, you know.
On reform, you sort of point out that sort of Keynesianism, post-Keynesianism, right. Keynesians have no real solution to this. You also have quite a lot of historical detail about the collapse of the Keynesian settlement in the first instance in the 70s. What do you make of the revival of this, not necessarily at the level of people like Paul Krugman or whatever, but the revival of it as one of the components, I think, in a sort of leftward shift that I think is visible in various places, obviously, for a while in Spain to enormously desultory effects in Greece, but also with sort of obvious people like Sanders and Corbyn. Yeah. With their economic seems, broadly speaking, to be Keynesian. Do you think that this is something that will come back to?
Well, I have two observations about that. One is, it's not going to work in the long run. In the short run, I can imagine some breathing space being given by something of this kind. Yep. In fact, I think, as I emphasize in the book, capitalism was probably saved by Chinese expansionism after 2007-2008, which involved China going immensely into debt. I mean, the debt in China has soared after 2007-2008 as they built high-speed rail networks, cities, and, you know, tremendous infrastructures. And this was a very significant way in which the global economy, I think, was stabilized by the China expansion after 2007-2008. And the China expansion was sort of a Keynesian program. And this then generated the peculiar thing at the time. You have one half of the world which is playing austerity politics, which was the monetarist solution, and the other half of the world doing the expansionist Keynesian politics. And, you know, that's managed to stabilize things. But the Chinese are in a lot of difficulty now. They've got an incredible debt problem that they've got to work out. The one advantage they have over places like Greece is they're indebted in their own currency, which makes it easier to much easier to manage. But they've also got overproduction and they don't know what to do with it. So one of the things you suddenly see is China's exporting capital like crazy all around the world. They're building railroads in, you know, East Africa. They're building things in Latin America. They've got this One Belt One Road idea coming, and they're putting a lot of, you know, money into that, and a lot of their excess capacity in cement production and copper and steel is all going into,
as we saw in Port Talbot.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a very very dynamic situation. So I'm not saying that the Keynesian thing couldn't, but there are elements of the Keynesian thing which would be very reluctant for, you know, people like Krugman and so on to access. I mean, one of the things that Keynes insisted was the purchasing power of the working class had to rise very significantly. And the only way that could happen was by empowering the working class, which is why Keynes was in favor of unionized, you know, Keynesian solution involved strong unions and all the rest of it. Well, imagine trying to get that in the United States right now. Forget it. So the Keynesian thing is there. It'd be incomplete. It might buy a little time, as it did in the China case from 2007 to about 2013. The world's, the global economy was in hot, was really indebted to China in the sense. But obviously, it can't go on forever. So then the question is, what happens now? And we're at that moment right now. And it was very interesting. The Financial Times, about 2 weeks ago, there was one edition of it, had five articles in different pages from different people, and different all. Two of them had exactly the same graph, which I actually have in here too, which is the level of Chinese indebtedness. And they kind of said, this whole system is in danger of blowing up, and we may wind up in a big financial crisis again. That was the theme of all of these five articles. Watch out. Everything looks good right now on the surface, but watch out.
So how do you rate the chances of, let's say, you know, all being well, a Labour government is elected in the snap election that Liz Truss looks like is going to happen next month, and John McDonnell gets to do this sort of expansionary Keynesian sort of infrastructure building, employment creating policy, how would you see that panning out?
I think, again, it would give us some breathing space. I suspect, by the way, that, I mean, there are signs around Europe that the kind of austerity mantra is diminishing a little bit in its intensity, and the recognition that maybe some give can go on, I think. So I think that, it will create the possibility for some transformation to occur. But it's going to run into trouble probably within 4 or 5 years. And then the question arises, what happens? Well, typically then you go back to the kind of, you know, conservative kind of thing. What actually is required right now is a revolutionary transformation of how capital accumulation is working. And I think there are all sorts of reasons why that has to be considered. There are environmental reasons. One of the big reasons, which is the compound rate of growth. compounding rates of growth when Marx was writing, when capital accumulation was just in one little part of the world. Now you're looking at compounding growth in China, India, Indonesia, you know. It's not going to work unless you totally financialize the system and then just have people actually living on off fictitious capital, which is kind of a very, very, it would be like a parlor game, you know, that people are playing, and then they'll be playing games about where can you best stash your, you know, paradise papers, money, you know, where do you do it, that kind of game. So I think that some serious thought has to be given with the whole kind of constructing alternatives, and it has to begin at the top. With dealing with state power and the power of central banks.
At which point we should go for questions.
I just wanted to go back to what you said earlier, David, about nothing new is coming out of crisis at the moment. Could you talk about, did anything come out new of any crisis in the past? And was there a build-up to... What's preventing anything new happening now? Or was there anything ever new? Or was it literally just crisis management all the time?
Well, it's bound to be crisis management all the time because, as I argued, capital is crisis-prone and therefore is always going to produce crises. There are various ways in which there can be responses to crises. One of the arguments I made about the past was there was always the possibility of what I call a spatial fix. That is, if you've got surplus capital and surplus labor in Britain, you lend money to Argentina to build railroads that actually use British steel and British rolling stock. So you get rid of the you parlay the crisis by expansionism, some sort of form of colonialism, and what in the 19th century would be called imperialism, and so on. So the crises of the 19th century were largely engineered by kind of spatial adjustments of various kinds. The relationship between the dynamics of the British economy and the US economy, for example. You notice that Britain's going up, the US is going down. Britain goes down, the US goes up, and so you get sort of oscillations of this kind. So there are various ways in which uneven geographical development was one of the ways in which crises were managed during that period. And we still see elements of that right now. China has surplus production capacity. The amount of capital that China exported suddenly exceeded the amount that was being imported into China, interestingly, in 2008. Since then, export of capital from China has gone like this, surged up, and it's absorbing. So the spatial thing is kind of very important. Then there's the kind of whole kind of question of the state power and the role of the state. The 1930s produced a crisis, and the main response to it was a Keynesian politics and a much stronger role for the state in terms of managing capital. So we have a period after World War II where there's a lot of state-owned enterprises, a lot of enterprises are nationalized in this country, elsewhere. So you get much more state management. And then that runs into the crisis of the 1970s, and one of the answers then, well, get the state out of that management, you privatize, you get a monetarist theory. All of the Keynesians who are in the World Bank are fired in 1982 and replaced by Chicago Boys and all the rest of it. So you get these shifts of this kind. Now, my point about this is, this doesn't solve problems, the crisis problems. I mean, one of the arguments I've been making for some time is that capitalism does not have an answer to its in crisis problems. It just moves the crisis around. It moves it from this sector to that sector. It moves it around. And actually how the global crisis of 2007-2008 arose and spread around the world was an interesting story of that. It began in a housing market. Then it got into finance. Then it became sovereign debt. It sort of moves around in its form. It moved around geographically. At first it was in California and Arizona, and then suddenly it's all over the place because people are bought into these crazy investment vehicles, and anyone who was crazy enough to do that got caught. So it moves around. So I think we have to understand that dynamic question. If the question is, can you imagine a crisis-free capitalism, the answer is no. It's always going to produce a crisis. The only interesting question is, where is it going to come from? Where has it gone to right now? What's it going to do?
My question was with regards to something that you did finish on previously, on this whole fact that the mantra of austerity seems to be sort of wearing off across Europe. Now, what I wanted to ask you is, do you think that this is, once again, just a temporary phenomenon, just a temporary measure by the political elites in Berlin, in Brussels, in Paris, in across Europe, in order to mitigate, mitigate the threat that's presented to them by the newfound forces that oppose austerity and oppose the European project? And here I'm talking about both Corbyn in the UK and various anti-austerity movements, sort of on the left, but also the sort of the populist and right-wing forces on the far right.
I mean, I'm no great expert on this. I mean, maybe you have a better answer to that. I mean, my impression would be that, yeah, I think the elites are running a bit scared, and they realize that they've got to back off a little bit on the austerity stuff. I mean, I think that's where it's, in part, where it's coming from. And I think they're concerned about the disaffection there is with the European Union. I think a little bit they were scared by Brexit. I think they're worried about, you know, the coherence of the. So I think that we're seeing some of this, but a lot of this is opportunistic. I mean, we're seeing a situation in the United States where the Republican Party has been absolutely against any kind of increase in indebtedness and has fought tooth and nail against it. And now they put a budget together where they're going to go $1.5 trillion in debt, and nobody says anything because, you know, this is just political opportunism of the worst sort. And a lot of this comes back to the class interest. And how can you, you know, satisfy the class interest? And I think that, you know, Trump comes in and says, well, we're going to do it this way, you know, and the Republican Party says, yeah, we can satisfy the class interest that way. And we'll try and do it. So again, it'll come back, I think, to this idea of, you know, making sure that the class interests are safeguarded by whatever politics makes things possible at a particular historical moment. So I don't think the austerity answer was ever serious in the sense that it was an absolute. It was a political strategy. Which to me came about at a particular historical moment for particular reasons. But you might have...
I'm fine with that. I'm looking for more questions.
Okay.
If there is a snap election next week, for example, which looks quite likely, given the gulf between the opposition and kind of Keynesianism that you were talking about earlier on, would you be, if they invited you in, would you be part of the team?
I'm sure McDonald would be keen. He'd have you.
Well, I'd be very happy to talk with them, but I don't. That's for you to sort of work out. I
mean, could you bridge the gap between your position and theirs?
I think they're. I mean, the political situation, as I see it, is that the left is not at this moment prepared to propose any really radical solutions to the current situation, or to contemplate some of the things that might be necessary so that everybody can have a decent life and a decent living environment in maybe 15, 20 years' time. I don't think the left is in a position to do that right now. And I think that the best that could be expected would be what I would call a program of reforms and hope that some of the reforms are what I would call revolutionary reforms. That is, reforms which open up the possibility of something in the future which is much more radical. I mean, when Marx wrote about this, he wrote about, you know, the realm of freedom begins when the realm of necessity gets left behind, and he goes on sort of about this and then says, so the limitation on the length of the working day is the beginning point. And I think there are elements of that kind. You might want to think about, you know, changing or obviously altering tax structures, altering some of the, creating some of the, doing some of the things that Corbyn, I think, wants to do, which is to abolish fees for higher education, abolish, you know, put much more money into the National Health Service, do all those kinds of things. But at the same time, I think that one of the things that's important in the Keynesian program would be to empower labor. And to the degree that a lot of labor is being disempowered by the employment structures that exist right now, you probably want a radical revision of labor law in such a way that it's possible to mobilize precarious workers within and as you know, as a form of labor which is going to be properly represented in the political arena. And there are things of that kind which open up some possibilities. But at the same time, you're going to have to deal with the fact that you know, capital doesn't, you know, like that kind of thing, and will engage in capital flight. And, you know, as happened when Mitterrand tried to do some very radical things in the first year of when he came to power, and immediately within 1 year, has to get turned turtle because basically capital is kind of walking away from things. So you've got to figure out how to stop capital flight. Hard to do in a situation where you don't have capital controls, but there may be a good reason to sort of go back to a system of capital controls which give you much more power. So the things of that sort which need to be thought through, and you have to do it in the basis on the, you know, it will be class struggle, and as we know about the capitalist class, they wage class struggle with brutality and no holds barred. And I think that, again, what you can do politically by opening up some things is one thing. And I think that a Corbyn administration, or if Podemos came to power or something like that, then opening up things would be the best that you could really try to do. But at the same time, there's an educational project, which is to educate people into the problems that exist with, you know, Theresa May saying that the only answer to, you know, the organization of society is a capitalist system, and that the answer to all of the problems of impoverishment and is more of that system which creates the impoverishment and creates the environmental disasters and creates all these problems. So I think there's an argument here that is very, you know, it's an important argument to have, but, you know, if I was around here and Corbyn came to power and they wanted to talk, I'd love to sit down and talk with them. Yeah. I doubt they will, but,
you know. Oh, stranger things have happened. Yeah. I think we've got time for one more.
So, David, finally, you used the words class struggle, which is the thing that I thought was possibly absent from everything that you've talked about so far. And I understand you've got this beef with people who are sort of obsessed with volume one, as you put it, and the, you know, the theory of labour value. Yeah. And you've made that very cogent and very clear, and I think importantly so as well. But I'm just curious about what you feel is, you know, the element of class struggle in Marx's whole thought. You know, to me, it's always been the determining thing. But you've talked about capital as though it sort of has a life of its own, irrespective of the struggle between these two classes on an international basis. So is that part of the way that you sort of construct your own ideas or have developed Marxism, or do you think that's kind of outdated now?
No, I have a... let me ask you the alternative way of looking at it. Class struggle is usually associated in the Marxist lexicon with struggles at the point of production. I'm arguing that there's a far broader terrain of struggle over everything from what Marx calls the free gifts of nature, which is the metabolic relation to nature. There is struggle over realization in the market. There's struggle over distribution relations, how much the rentiers are taking and the like. There's a struggle over free gifts of human nature and cultural kind of questions. So there are struggles over all these things. Now, do we call those all class struggles? Or do we say they are anti-capitalist struggles, but not class struggles? I'm of an inclination right now, so recently I've been writing more about anti-capitalist struggles and saying the environmental issue is an anti-capitalist struggle, but it's not a class struggle in the sense that it's workers versus capital, because the environmental question impinges upon all kinds of different configurations. And the same thing applies with those struggles which occur over realization. They are, now, I would be quite happy to call all of these struggles class struggles at a certain level, but I know it'll probably get misinterpreted that I'm talking just about production. So I don't know quite which language to use, whether to say, look, anti-capitalist struggle is not the same as class struggle. Class struggle is one form of anti-capitalist struggle. What goes on in the environmental movement is an anti-capitalist struggle, but it's not necessarily a class struggle, because many people in the environmental movement do not necessarily believe that capital is the problem. And the same thing applies over, you know, gender struggles and LGBT struggles and what goes on in the field of social reproduction. Are all those struggles sort of anti-capitalist struggles, or can some of them be anti-capitalist struggles? What's the relationship? You know, and I'm interested in the mobilizer. So I tend to write more about anti-capitalist struggles these days, because I think that the public perception of what you mean by class struggle is too much colored by a long history of Marxist and left thinking, which kind of says that's the only form of struggle that really matters, and it's actually located in the production process and in and around the production process. Which is, like I say, I'm not going to say that those struggles are irrelevant or important, unimportant. They're crucial, and in different parts of the world they have a different kind of character. But I'm inclined right now to distinguish between class struggle and anti-capitalist struggle, and to say that I'm in favor of anti-capitalist struggle. And the way I rewrite, and I am rewriting in some ways, Marx's total view of the different points of struggle and antagonism that exist, that he does describe in volume 3 of Capital. When, for example, he's looking at the crisis of 1848 and 1857, he doesn't call these class struggles. He doesn't mention class struggle. He says these are financial and commercial crises, and their causes have to do with financial and commercial conditions. At that point, he's actually got a different theory of crisis than simply the class theory that he's earlier imagined. I mean, this is why I'm very doubtful about the kind of falling rate of profit thesis, because in the two places where he describes in great detail his view of capitalist crises, he doesn't mention falling rate of profit at all, which is 1848 and 1857. He mentions commercial and financial conditions. And actually his description of what happens in 1848 and 1857 is a dead ringer for what happens in 2007, 2008. I mean, I put a long quote in the book, which is a quote from volume 3 of Capital, and I just changed the language. So instead of talking about, the sort of language he used, I introduced mortgages into it, and it's a dead statement for 2007, 2008. So do you call the crisis of 2007, 2008 a class struggle crisis? Yeah, you want to call it that. There is a way in which I can do that, which is I know who the capitalist class is. And it's easy to identify who the capitalist class is. And so in that sense, all the forms of anti-capitalist struggle are against that class. But that class is doing many different things. It's extracting rents, it's messing around with your telephone charges, and it's messing around with your credit card fees, and it's doing all of these kinds of things. If we could redefine class that way, I'd say let's call it all class struggle, because it is anti-capitalist struggle. But it's very difficult to get people who are used to the language of class struggle applying simply to workers at the point of production to accept these other forms of struggle and say, oh yeah, that housing crisis, I mean, you know, it's crazy, it's 2007, 2008. I had to attempt an analysis of the crisis, and I come along and I find all these people, you know, coming from God knows where, who kind of say, well, it's the falling rate of profit, isn't it? And you kind of go, I don't see the falling rate of profit in there. I'm sorry, I don't see it. It was a crisis of speculation in housing and an asset bubble, and it burst, and it had these financial and commercial consequences. But we know who's behind it, and we know who's benefiting from it, and we know where the hedge funds are, and we know what they're doing, and we know what George Soros did with the British pound. We know that in 7 days, George Soros stole over $1 million, or was it a billion or a million? It was about $1 billion he stole in 7 days off the British public. And this, and it was perfectly legal, and this is what I call accumulation by dispossession, that he did this, you know, betting against the pound and the ARM. So, yeah, we know who they are, and if we could put our minds and say, all right, that class has to be dispossessed, has to lose its power, and we have to go after it, I like to do that, but it's a difficult language to use when you use the term class struggle casually. Otherwise, I like I say, I tend to write about anti-capitalist struggle these days, with class struggle embedded in anti-capitalist struggle, because that allows me to look at things like the housing crisis for what it actually was and how it occurred without necessarily being involved in this imaginary of a point of production struggle which is going on.
I've always been rather tickled by the fact that the money that Soros made out of collapsing the British economy was spent on Eastern European civil society organisations. Yes. I find that rather touching. But on that note, I think we should finish. David will be signing his books, which he has produced as the Silkworm produces silk.
Yes, Silkworm Lager is the last wonderful way in which Marx talked about Milton writing Paradise Lost. It was sort of, the question was, did Milton in writing Paradise Lost produce value? And Marx's answer was no, he just wrote it out of his own nature, just as a silkworm makes silk out of its own nature. So I think silkworm labor is kind of what I think I'm doing all the time. So.
But the books will be for sale.
Yeah, yeah. I do point out that when they get commercialized, there's a point of commercialization. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you
for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.